Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregel Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda.
The surface of the planet isn't really increasing, so it's very important to kind of understand in a quantitative way where the limits are and how we're bumping up against limits, and then what the implications are for policies. I think a price on carbon is probably one of the most important things we can be pushing for, because it absolutely does help to get the cost borne by the right players in the economic system.
I'm very pleased today to introduce Susan Barnes. Susan's co-founder and director of Finance for Change at Global Footprint Network, one of the most highly respected scientific organizations addressing global ecological limits. Global Footprint Network aims to accelerate the use of the ecological footprint, a resource accounting tool that measures how much nature we have, how much we use, and who uses what. The network envisages a future in which human demands on nature are monitored as closely as the stock market. Thank you very much, Susan, for taking the time today to speak to the sustainability agenda.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thanks.
I'm very much looking forward to hearing your background and journey and more about the Global Footprint Network. That might be a good place to start, if you could tell me a little bit about what you do and how you ended up here.
Yeah, thank you. So Global Footprint Network is a research organization that really is looking at resource flows around the world. We've been engaged in resource accounting since 2003. And we're really trying to bring, you know, quantitative information to decision makers, whether it's in decision makers in government or in finance or in the development space, in terms of, development agencies that may be working with communities trying to improve quality of life. So there's a lot of, the whole premise is that this idea of ecological overshoot, or the fact that humanity is demanding more from the planet than the planet can regenerate every year, this has very important implications for policies at the national level, very important implications for investors, and for all, anybody trying to improve quality of life on the planet. So, and we're really trying to bring much more robust data to decisions. We all know that population increases and consumption increases are having an effect, but we want to bring more precise and more economically relevant information to decision makers so they can improve their policies. So that's what we've been doing. And for the last 4 years, I've personally been focused on bringing this information to the finance industry. And the reason is that the economic health of countries is more and more impacted by resource trends. And yet sovereign bond investors, those investors that invest in the debt of countries, really do benefit from better information on the resource side. So that's what we've been engaged in. We just launched a report a couple of weeks ago in London looking at food price shocks, for example, but we're also working in the area of carbon and climate and those sorts of risks, how they impact on countries, and then therefore how they impact on their sovereign debt.
Right. Very interesting and very important, clearly, given the growing role of the finance industry. You talk a little bit about the ecological footprint. What is it that's distinctive and most useful about this approach?
Well, the ecological footprint is more than just an index or an indicator. It's actually an accounting system. So it's quite handy, really, because we have one planet. We know how much surface of the planet we have. We can measure how productive the planet is in a number of different areas. The productivity of our forests, our cropland, our grazing land, our fishing grounds, and also how much land we have available to absorb CO2. So that's on the supply side. And then we can look at how much humanity demands. And we look at that on a per capita basis. We look at it from the perspective of a country, a city, or any economic activity can have its ecological footprint measured. So it's an accounting system that has two sides of a balance sheet, and you can compare, you know, demand with supply. And so it's really the only indicator of its kind. And it's I think it's important because as humanity's demands increase, its consumption and population, you know, the surface of the planet isn't really increasing. So it's very important to kind of understand in a quantitative way where the limits are and you know how we're bumping up against limits and then what the implications are for policies.
Because that brings up the question of who is the audience for this information. I guess it brings up the question of, you know, externalities and the idea of maybe free riders, the sense that, you know, something might be happening, but how does that connect to our own individual behavior? If you look at, you know, some global figures about, you know, as you mentioned, some of these statistics about the overall scale of the footprint, you know, how does that tie in then with corporate and indeed, you know, government and country scale initiatives?
Yeah, good question. Well, yeah, where do I start? So it is really interesting to just see the different dynamics that occur based on different individual consumption patterns or country consumption patterns. I think that can have a lot of policy implications and also kind of reveal some of the unintended consequences of our economic system, in fact. So, you know, we could start by even thinking about carbon emissions, for example. Most people know that it's the demand of higher income countries that are driving carbon emissions. And yet countries that are producing our goods and services, like China and India, are really burdened economically with the risks associated with carbon emissions. So if kind of from a maybe an equity perspective or just trying to understand the dynamics, I think it can, you know, the footprint can reveal a lot of important dilemmas. Some of our recent research, for example, we just, as I said, launched a report at Standard & Poor's a few weeks ago in London, and we looked at food price shocks. So if you really understand, you know, the pressures that are being put on our food system right now, we've got growing populations and diets shifting as populations are increasing their income. They often will switch to meat-based diets. Are causing a dynamic which causes higher food prices and more volatile food prices. And what we did was then look at what were the impact on countries and also, you know, their economies. And what we found was the countries that are driving the higher food prices are not the ones that actually are hurt by these food prices by and large. It's more low-income countries that, you know, really bear the brunt of food price shocks, which can cause higher inflation, which can, in countries that have tenuous social situations, can also cause social unrest. So it's very similar to what we see with the impacts of physical climate change. You know, the countries that are driving the carbon emissions are not always the one, are often not the ones who are suffering from the physical impacts of climate change, whether it's droughts or hurricanes. I mean, it's not that countries like the United States don't get hit by these effects, but their economies are more resilient. So lower income and emerging market economies, they're more fragile. So this is something that I think really needs to be elevated as a discussion among policymakers. What, you know, how do we build the resilience of low-income countries and, you know, so that they're just more resilient to these sorts of shocks, whether it's climate change or food price shocks and, you know, these other issues that are, water stress is another big one.
I'm thinking about the work that you talked about with the sovereign risk, the sovereign debt, and I'm just wondering, underlying this Is there a connection between doing good or trying to stop doing the bad things, the things that are, you know, causing problems? That should be connected into the financial system, so that if a country is doing better, even a company is doing better, there should be some reward for that, some financial reward. And presumably the other side of that is even starker, that countries that are doing bad or doing worse should pay more, or there should be some risk premium, or the financial system in some way should reflect that. I'm wondering how important is that idea, and how well developed is it?
Yeah, I think that's very important. It's interesting when people should feel great about what happened in Paris. So the fact that governments came together and had a really successful global agreement. So that's very positive. But behind the scenes, one of the things we think a lot about is how do you motivate governments to, you know, follow through, to take action, to change their policies, change the way that they're investing, the subsidies that they're delivering to the fossil fuel industry. There's all kinds of activities that we want to change inside governments. And what we're excited about is bringing really the economic angle of it, really proving, you know, putting ethics aside and putting what the right thing to do aside, but basically looking at the hard numbers of the economic risks to a country if they don't transition. That's what we're really trying to do. And so one of the most exciting things about working in the finance industry is that, I mean, one of the reasons why Paris was so successful, I think, really was that investors were involved. I mean, it's not the only reason. There were a lot of things that fell into place, and a lot of things that the negotiators did right last year. But one of the things that fueled, the strength of the negotiations was that investors were at the table. So when it comes to sovereign bonds, it's really interesting because sovereign bond investors look at economic fundamentals, but for the most part, what we're finding is they really need better information about climate risk and carbon transition risk and water stress, and because they're becoming real economic issues now. So that what we're trying to do also is to get, you know, investors to have conversations with governments when they invest in their debt. They do ask questions about all kinds of economic fundamentals, but are they also asking questions about the unburnable carbon that the country might have on its, you know, quote unquote balance sheet? Are they asking questions about the investments that the country's making in, you know, clean technology and low carbon economic, you know, systems? So it's one of the things we're excited about is getting more of a dialogue going on between governments and investors. If you look at what's going on in the industry in general, there's of course a lot of great work being done on the company side, looking at stocks, you know, looking at oil companies and coal companies, a lot of great activity there. But only 25% of the unburnable carbon in the world is controlled by companies that are publicly traded. 75% of the oil reserves in the world are controlled by governments and private, you know, state-owned companies. So it's kind of, you know, we think of the sovereign bond market as sort of a sleepier part of the finance industry. And, you know, I feel like we have to get all parts of the financial system engaged, whether it's bond investors or credit rating agencies. We want the environment ministries inside of governments engaged, but we also want their finance ministries engaged. So that's some of the most exciting work, I think, that, you know, is sort of on the horizon for the year ahead.
I guess what I'm interested in is talking about is, you know, the finance for change, that, you know, the report you've just done on the sovereign credit risk, and thinking about it in the context maybe of COP21 and the fact that the nations, you know, are taking more of a stance and stronger action on that. So I guess it's to really just ask, you know, what was the research about? What were the main findings, and what do you think would be the results of that, and maybe who the audience is?
In the larger context around governments taking action on climate change, it's true that the Paris Agreement was just a complete watershed moment. And, you know, I think it couldn't have gone better given all the challenges that we've had in prior negotiations. So that was quite quite encouraging. At the same time, we realize that action on climate change has to happen pretty much in the next 5 years. If it's delayed much more, you know, if countries drag their feet, there's a possibility of it being more expensive and more economically damaging to economies, just and more difficult. And then there's also a greater chance that we're not going to meet the mark. So even though we should feel very optimistic about Paris, there's also incredible urgency. And so one of the reasons why, you know, we're so engaged with this work is that credit rating agencies and sovereign bond investors have a really influential voice on over governments. So, you know, governments are more likely to follow the lead of their central bank or their finance ministry than their environment ministry, unfortunately, but that's the case. So our work can actually help to arm environment ministries with real economic risk data, that so they can have a dialogue inside their country about, yes, it's important for the planet, it's important for people, but it's also essential to our economic health. And by the way, bond investors are looking at this, and credit rating agencies are looking at what our country is doing. You know, what investments are we making or not making? So, you know, a lot of governments have made, you know, very important steps in their INDCs, the commitments, the public commitments that they've made to reducing carbon. But that really needs to be compared to what the governments are actually doing every year. How are they setting their budgets? Are they still subsidizing fossil fuels, or are they, really changing their policies at the national level? So that's one of the reasons why we're so engaged with bond investors.
Right, right. That's very interesting. Just a quick question there. When you talk about bond investors, who are these in the main? Because I know there's a lot of institutional investors and pension funds and things, but you do hear about bond vigilantes and things, not necessarily on climate change at the moment, but presumably one day they might. Can you talk a little bit about who this group is?
Sure. So, you know, asset managers like pension funds asset owners like pension funds hire asset managers to manage all their assets. And it's really those, it's an interesting relationship. So the asset managers sometimes are thought of as the experts, and they really ought to be really getting their head around how do we measure risk in these portfolios. But they usually take their cues from asset owners like pension funds, who say, look, we don't want to invest in countries that are making the problem worse, or, you know, we want to invest in, you know, green bonds or whatever it is. So they look to the asset managers, companies like BlackRock or Alliance Bernstein. They're just very large asset managers. They manage all kinds of different portfolios. So those are the ones we're really working with, because they really need to be armed with better risk frameworks for really understanding and helping asset owners do what they really want to do.
That's interesting. And the asset owners, are they asking these questions? Are they saying, because presumably there's a risk here, and therefore, you know, fiduciary responsibility to think about these risks and start asking, when is this going to really start to hit my portfolio, and what kind of risks are they?
Yeah, and they're all over the board. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, leadership being demonstrated, but also, you know, a lot of asset owners still, especially in the United States, unfortunately, that just don't see it as a fiduciary responsibility. They don't see it as a material, you know, risk. They may have political, leanings that get in the way of them understanding the risk. But so it's all over the board, really.
And what's the main mechanism for asset owners that are thinking about this? Because I know there are various different initiatives to take into account ESG type factors, but are there one or two groupings that you think particularly influential here?
There's PRI. I mean, signing on as a PRI signatory is an important step, and they've got a They've got a carbon disclosure project that folks can join and engage with other investors on. So I think that's really probably the way where to look.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And what was the outcome of your research? I mean, the idea was to start taking into account risk factors, and therefore, I guess, presumably that would ultimately affect pricing and risk of sovereign debt of different countries.
Right. So we did just launch a report, and this report was actually focused on food price shocks, and which is actually definitely related to climate change. So what's really happening is that there's a bigger gap between what our cropland can actually supply and what we're really demanding. And that has to do with, you know, growing populations, rising income, which tends to encourage meat-based diets. And at the same time, you know, there's not a lot more land to cultivate. And the land that we do have, there's some land maybe in Africa that can be, we can get a little bit more productivity out of, but the ability of the earth to really supply the flow of food that we need is, there's just a growing gap. And what happens there, what that really causes is higher prices and higher price volatility, and can lead to food price shocks like what we saw in 2008, which a lot of people don't even think about it anymore, but it wasn't that long ago, and it was, you know, had a huge impact on economies. So what we did was we said, what would happen if we had another food price shock on the order of what we had in 2008, and what would be the impact on 110 countries? And we looked at their GDP growth, we looked at their balance of payments, and we looked at their inflation. What we found was there could be significant economic impacts on countries. By and large, it tends to be lower income countries that are mostly affected. That's partially because a bigger share of their household expenditures are on food compared to wealthier countries. So, you know, individuals are affected. Inflation could be high because of that. On a total basis, India and China would have had sort of the biggest total impact on their economies. But, you know, it kind of, you know, taking a step back in terms of, you know, what does this research really mean? We see a pattern that I think from a larger perspective, we really do need to address. And that is that the drivers of environmental and resource pressures come from higher income countries. You know, the carbon emissions largely come from countries that consume a lot of fossil fuels, and the drivers of food price shocks also come from higher income countries. And yet it's the lower income countries that are bearing the brunt of the impact. And these are countries that actually they actually need more investment. They don't, you know, they're countries that need more support, and not, you know, partially because they're being hit by climate change impacts and price volatility around food. And they also, you know, they need investment there, but they're riskier investments. So that's kind of the conundrum, is that these are countries that are, whose credit ratings are already low, can be relatively low. These sorts of environmental and resource pressures can actually even push their credit ratings down further, making cost of capital higher for them at a time when that's the last thing they need. So I think there ought to be a conversation about how countries can be supported, how they can be made more resilient. There's Swiss Re, for example, just got done with doing a study with S&P looking at disaster risk and the fact that a lot of countries are not adequately insured. So, you know, making sure that these countries have proper insurance, that countries have crop insurance. There's a lot of different financial mechanisms and economic mechanisms that can be put into place. But I think it really just needs to be focused on quite a bit more.
And what's the next stage in this research? Is there something specific in mind, or just a more general intention to look at different parts of this, you know, bigger question?
Well, we're doing two different things. The first thing is we're going to start to engage more with governments. After we launched the food price shock research in London, I think it was last month, we also went down to Nairobi to the UNECA conference, where there were 110 ministers gathered there. And there was a lot of interest in this kind of data and in a dialogue around, you know, economic risk. So we're going to be, in the next year, we're going to be doing, you know, conducting more dialogues. We'd like to see credit rating agencies talking to governments, talking to investors who invest in these governments' bonds, and just having a bigger dialogue about how to address risks. So that's one thing that we're going to be doing. The second thing is that, you know, there's a lot of activity around divestment and looking at the 2-degree transition, and all of this research tends to be focused on companies and specific economic sectors or specific countries, and which is great work, really. What we want to do next is to pull all this research together in a form that can be used by sovereign bond investors, because bond investors need to have an sort of an even treatment of every country. They need, you know, rankings. They need to look at it from a global perspective, because they'll have, you know, a portfolio of a number of countries they're investing in, and they want to be able to compare. And to our knowledge, there isn't any sort of tool out there yet. And we, you know, we're just right on the cusp of being able to, you know, pull that research together and offer it to investors. So that's one of our next projects.
What's the response been from finance ministers, and to what extent are they paying more attention to these kind of questions?
You know, it really varies a lot country to country. There's a bunch of countries where it's not on their radar at all. You know, we know about that England is definitely on the forefront of being, you know, really understanding these sorts of risks. So, I think there's still an audience that is sort of starting to wake up, but I'm sure it'll increase a lot through the remaining of the year.
Great. Well, I guess the more research that's done and the more evidence and information that's available will help to get the message across. Thank you for that. That's been really helpful.
What I'm finding is that there is a lot of interest in doing something, but by and large, people just need the tools. You know, the methodologies for measuring these things are complex, and a lot of investors just don't have the time or the expertise maybe to really drill down and sort it all out. So it's actually not so much, in some cases, it's not so much a question of will, it's just the mechanics of it. So I think that's the nice thing about being able to bring, you know, frameworks to the market, because then they can just get picked up and propagated, and that can really help a lot.
Sounds vitally important work. It seems to be obvious in a way, doesn't it, that particularly coming out of COP21 and things, that if countries are going to be talking about this, because this is clearly a big issue in the whole externalities, isn't it? The no connection between the pricing of who generates pollution and who bears the cost of it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's fascinating. And I'd like to come back maybe to that proportions you talked about, the ratio of the 25%, 75%. But I'm just wondering how asymmetry, in the sense that, you know, the countries that are causing more of the problems aren't necessarily the ones that are seeing the consequences. So how does that play out in sovereign risk, in the sense that, you know, you might be a polluter country in a sense, but you don't bear the burden of that?
Yeah, no, it really reveals a flaw in the economic system, in that countries, lower income countries, that are often, you know, producing the goods and services that the higher income countries consume, are bearing the brunt of the risk. I don't have any easy answers, but I think it definitely needs to be raised and discussed. Some really good work that's being done right now with S&P and Swiss Re, they just came out with a report called The Heat Is On, And they looked at the vulnerability of countries, their credit worthiness, basically, in the event that countries are suffering from climate change risk. And on the positive side, I mean, Swiss Re is doing some good work now around making sure that countries have access to crop insurance, for example. There has to be some kind of pooling of risk or some way in which, you know, fiscal or financial instruments that can be employed to help soften the blow and to, you know, to kind of pool the risk, because right now it's very one-sided. So I think that, you know, Swiss Re's got some really interesting innovations around bringing crop insurance to very small farmers, using, you know, cell phone technology and like sort of just-in-time delivery of insurance. So that's just one example.
Right, right.
But they're,
It brings up, I guess, an interesting question in the sense that where does a price for carbon fit in here? And how would that change things, assuming, you know, in 10 years or 5 years that was established and operational? Would that make the connection between polluting and economic costs clearer? And how do you see that?
Absolutely. That's a great point. I think a price on carbon is probably one of the most important things we can be pushing for, because it absolutely does help to get the costs borne by the right players in the economic system. There's a really great report that was just came out earlier this year by the IMF called After Paris. And one of their top recommendations is employing a price on carbon and all the economic benefits that can, you know, accrue from that.
That's been a criticism or a comment some people have made, isn't it? That notwithstanding all the progress, that remains a major hurdle.
And it's a great way to, you know, fund what we need to fund. And you know, establishing the right price signals. Yeah, it's really the one thing I think should be at the top of everyone's list.
This resource accounting is fascinating, really, because it's an area that's been neglected and presumably tied in with the whole area of economic externalities, which have been taught in economics for decades. But are we making progress there?
You know, I think so much more needs to be done. It's a really great question. You know, one of the things I was really happy about in terms of the Paris Agreement was that they included many more elements in addition to carbon emissions. So the way we manage our land, and of course emissions from land conversion or any kind of land management are important, but also the ability of countries to absorb CO2 really needs to be valued. So the Paris Agreement signaled that there's more to consider than just carbon emissions, that land is important, and we're looking at a net zero carbon world. So, you know, we're taking into account the ability of our land to absorb. But the problem is that there aren't really good policy or economic instruments that can reward a country for keeping its forest standing, you know, or you know, a forest is only really valuable if the trees are cut. This is a a huge problem, and so we're only in the very beginning stages, I think, of developing, you know, international agreements and economic structures that will reward countries for absorbing CO2 and for managing land. I mean, the RED program is one great example of an innovation, of course. But, you know, really a lot more needs to be done. And otherwise, these incentives are going to be driving us in the exact wrong direction. It's one of the reasons why I'm fond of the ecological footprint as a measure as well, just to kind of bring it around to the footprint again, because as we try to move out of carbon, we're going to be putting more pressure on our land, and our land will be, you know, even more important, and there'll be more competing demands. And so, and the footprint can actually look at, you know, it's because it's measuring everything in one unit, it can look at the trade-offs between, you know, if I cut the forest to grow more food, or do I keep the forest standing to absorb CO2, or do I convert cropland to grazing land to raise cattle? I mean, it's, you know, there's only so much surface, and this is, you know, it's a tool for helping us manage these trade-offs. But, you know, getting out of carbon is going to put a huge demand on the land. And so I think, you know, a lot more needs to be done in terms of, you know, like I said before, rewarding countries for managing these assets for the world.
That's very interesting. When it comes to corporate sustainability, what began as, you know, maybe more of a reputation or a PR type thing has, for certainly many leading companies, become an economic and business agenda. It's become something that is important financially for the companies, not just in terms of saving costs, but also in terms of, you know, growth. Some companies like Unilever and so forth, a clear business case for sustainability. And you talked about that as well. I guess in some sense, that's part of what is important at a government level, that it gets translated beyond it's a good thing to do or the right thing to do to something that's economically essential to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it goes beyond just climate, but also, you know, a company's entire supply chain. And water, you know, is a great example. You know, where does a company site its plants? Where does it source its supply? Where, you know, these sort of these constraints are really essential to understand. Aside from, you know, just the customer expectations these days and what people really, you know, expect from companies. You know, I think the, you know, being an American, I'm often obviously dismayed at how backward our federal government has been. But of course, you know, leading companies, global corporations, have been on the forefront of you know, addressing climate change and many other types of resource constraints for a long time.
To some degree, there's, you know, now clearer mechanisms in terms of stock market performance, how investors respond, the degree to which they're taking into account, you know, these kind of risks. It seems that the cause and effect and the, I guess, the location of the economic response to a company's sustainability efforts is becoming clearer, but maybe at a state level and a government level, that's not so clear.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think it seems to me like that corporations have been engaged in this conversation for so much longer than governments have. You know, I used to work a lot with corporations, and I really like it because they're more nimble. You know, and governments are inherently difficult because you can get a lot of progress, and then, you know, you have a change of administration and everything gets stalled. I mean, it's true. I think it's pretty clear that companies have made the case, and a lot of companies are benefiting, you know, from a, you know, progressive approach to sustainability.
That's it. Very interesting. See the connection, and clearly the work you've done in terms of sovereign bonds is an important part of that, making that connection between, you know, risky behavior, bad behavior, and financial returns.
It's a big task, but it's exciting, and you know, it's just it's kind of like you have to have all parts of the system engaged, and I think that's the interesting part now, is just getting folks engaged that have been, you know, literally last year I would talk to some investors who just didn't believe the governments would have an agreement in Paris, so it wasn't on their radar. They didn't think it was important to look at, and so everything's changed in the space of a year. So this is I think it's really exciting times right now.
Yes. And in terms of governments, then, I mean, what are a few things that you think would really help make this connection and help get change there? One of these is clearly this connection between the price that governments pay for their debt and the riskiness and their contribution to climate change and to just sustainability generally. Are there a couple of other things that you think are essential?
I'd say if you just look at the, you know, what we're calling, people are calling the transition risk. I think one thing that's really important to do is to look at, for every government, to say, you know, what does our economy look like in a 2-degree world? You know, what's our carbon budget? And then find those areas that they can focus on improving, whether it's their energy mix or even the way that the economy generates value. So even for an oil producing nation, we've been really impressed with the United Arab Emirates, which has been for over 5 years, probably more, diversifying its economy. So it's, it has a lot of oil revenue, but less so now because of the low prices, but over the structure of their economy has really shifted. And now they're one of the leading producers of solar panels and low carbon technologies, whereas other oil producing nations have just been using this oil income as current income, which is really making the country vulnerable. So, yeah, I'd say we're really interested in where the country is in terms of its carbon intensity, how far it needs to go to transition to a two degree world. And then it's really interesting to look at their INDCs, or their intended carbon reduction plans that they put forth in Paris, and to say how robust are these INDCs? Are they going to do the job? How much further does the country need to go to meet the gap between where it is and where it needs to go? And there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Paris was a wonderful success, and the work has only begun.
Just maybe finally, that question about what governments should do, what are some of the things that you think will help make them do it?
I guess I'm so focused on on the investor side, and I don't want to overstate it, but at the same time, governments really do sit up and take notice when credit rating agencies comment on the things that are important to them, or when debt investors ask questions. So, I think that's one important lever. And the more we can make the economic case, the better, especially a case on the positive side. So kind of rewarding countries or making the case that their economy will be stronger in a 2-degree world, which is now going to be inevitable. I mean, it's an irreversible movement towards decarbonization. It's not even a question anymore. So the more we can, get that conversation going and bringing quantitative economic information to these decision makers, the better.
If I understand correctly, what you're doing is looking at scenarios and saying what countries will do well and do less well in a 2-degree world, where the temperature's gone up 2 degrees. But how does that connect then with who's actually driving that, a bad country?
I wish I had an easy answer for that. I think it's it's beyond tragic. It's actually,
I suppose it comes back to that, to the question of the carbon pricing again. It's just making that connection between cause and effect, that the countries that, are doing good, as you say, that are growing forests or making their forests, keeping their forests and reducing carbon generally, they should be compensated, or there should be, a mechanism that reflects that behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the way to correct an economic system that's not really working for us. It's not designed to deliver what we really want.
Are you optimistic, Susan? Where are we on the journey?
I'm optimistic. I'm just constantly amazed at the number of intelligent, ambitious, amazing people that are throwing everything they have at this at this issue, and not only people but institutions. I mean, the largest investors, the largest corporations, some very impressive countries. I mean, I think the momentum is all going in the right direction. And at the same time, you know, I'm it's pretty obvious that we're in for a rocky road. I mean, we already have many millions of people suffering the effects of climate change now, and resource scarcity. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because in wealthier countries, it's easy to say, oh, you know, life looks pretty normal to me. But the, you know, the impacts are already being felt in devastating ways. And so, you know, it's the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed.
I was about to quote William Gibson, actually, because I read an interview with him recently where he said that people said that he had a very dystopian view of the future. And he said, well, actually, for many people living in awful conditions around the world, they would actually be quite happy to live in the landscape of one of his books than in the terrible worlds they live in. And, you know, that are where these places have resource depletion and, you know, just terrible, terrible conditions.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, Susan. That's been a fascinating discussion, and I really enjoyed that. And it's very interesting to see the great work that you're doing. And I wish you the best with that. And thank you very much for taking your time to speak to the Sustainability Agenda today.
Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.